Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Jenny Dearborn, Senior Vice President, Chief Learning Officer, SAP. It's my pleasure to introduce Benedict Carey, New York Times science reporter and author of How We Learn, The Surprising Truth About When, Where, and Why It Happens. Ben graduated from the University of Colorado with a bachelor's degree in math and received his master's degree in journalism from Northwestern University. He started his career in San Francisco and has been with the New York Times since 2004. Ben covers brain and behavior topics and also writes about psychiatry, neurology, and everyday psychology. He is one of the newspaper's most popular and most emailed reporters. In addition to his latest book, How We Learn, Ben has also written two science mysteries for middle school-aged children. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Benedict Carey.
Hello, good afternoon. Thanks, Jenny, very much. I'm going to talk about learning a little bit today, personal topic. I want to start by saying, I gave up on learning. I was 18. I was done. I was not going to do it anymore. I was in my room reading maybe the 12th or 13th rejection letter from colleges, and I was, feeling rejected, hurt, angry, and I thought, what am I doing? I mean, I had been such a good student in high school. I'd been sort of playing by the rules, disciplined, I had to study ritual. I was a good student, getting decent grades and so on. And here I was learning that I wasn't getting into school. No one wanted to take me as, as a student. And, when you're 18, you're a purist. And I just thought, I'm done with this. I've got to do something else. Maybe hit the road. I don't know. Just move to Vegas. And, of course, I calmed down. And eventually, time passed. And I did go to college, a college. And I realized I couldn't completely give up on learning. Still had to do a little bit. But I approached it differently. And the best way to explain it is I decided I'd have a little more fun. I wouldn't be the perfect student anymore. I'd live for the day a little bit. And I wouldn't make studies the central part of my life. I would allow it to flow into the rest of my life, to integrate the two a little bit. And I'm going to tell you a story about how that looked sometimes. It looked strange, but it's a story of me and my roommate, Pete. We went one night to study for a calculus exam. We were pretty serious about it. We wanted to do well. And so I had reserved a room in the library, University of Colorado Main Library, huge building. And they had these study rooms, and I reserved one. I loved studying with other people. We could talk about stuff, and we could laugh, and we could sort of gossip along with studying, as long as we did some studying. In any case, we got this room, which I thought was perfect, quiet, sort of a quiet corner of the library. And we started working problems and so on. It was going fine until a friend of ours settled down in a cubicle nearby. We could see him through the glass door. And he was, I don't know what he was trying to study, but he had one of these things where his head was, like this. And we tried not to look at him, but it was impossible. So we were just laughing our heads off, there. And I thought, I don't know what's happening in this room, but studying is not one of the things. And so I said, look, Pete, I know some other rooms we can go to in the library. Back then, when dinosaurs strode the earth and I was in college, all the buildings were open. You could go into the math building or the chemistry building and just walk in there. The classrooms were open. And so was the library, and you could kind of explore all the floors and so on. So I said to Pete, look, let's go up to, I know a room, another room. Let's get out of here because we're laughing too hard, and this has got a blackboard and everything. And so up we go, and now we're in this other room. We're studying some more. And then he's an artist, and he starts doodling on the blackboard, and he's doing cartoons and then naked women, and he's getting engrossed. And I finally said, again, this is not working for the calculus, goal. So I knew of yet another room on the very top of the library, and I said, let's try it, right? Because you're going to be doodling the rest of the night otherwise. So off we go, and now in this corner room in the very top of this large library, and we're doing fine. And now it's my turn to interrupt the studies, and I've just got restless, and I said, let's go on the roof. I knew I'd been in this room. There was a fire escape there with a platform. You just lift up the window, you go straight up to the roof. So we did. We went up to the roof. It's a huge roof, like the size of a football field, gravel. And we're walking along and just telling jokes and so on. We get to the edge, and there's a wall about up waist high. And from there, you can see the entire courtyard and the campus and so on. And he's busy waving to people and yelling and so on. And I see that there's a security guard who's pointing at us now. Right. And so I tell Pete to stop waving and yelling at people. And the security guard pointing and saying something to us, so we decide to take off, obviously. Well, I'm not completely sure it's a security guard, so I turn around and go back and look over again. Well, now there's nobody down there, so I think, well, I'll just be safe. I turn around, and Pete's gone. Totally gone. And I'm thinking, shit. Right? I mean, I think he's gone over. There's no place else to go, right? And it was just one of those moments. I mean, I just had no feeling in my legs like that. And my first thought was his mom. I thought, she used to like me so much. What am I going to say to her? We went to study calculus and he fell off the building? I mean, what kind of a story is that, right? Well, I hear his voice, of course, finally, and I kind of go towards it, and he's hiding behind a little ledge, that's pretty much invisible. And so, ha-ha, very funny practical joke. Well, then we scramble out. So that was the study session we had for calculus. I felt pretty much doomed. The exam the next day. But I did a whole lot better than I thought. And, my first thought was, well, this must be a fluke, because I sure haven't studied. Right? But I had. Okay. I have been a science reporter for almost 30 years now. And we cover stories of all kinds, things that are important and interesting and so on. But you're always looking for a really good story, a human story that involves human drama, of course. But as a science writer, you want to tell a great science story. And I can tell you, in brain science, which is what I cover for the New York Times, it's a pretty rare bird, right? Because the brain is, like you sort of see this mysterious, vibrating organ with some of the smartest people in the world trying to break the code, trying to find out just to get started, how to understand the brain. And it's not giving up its secrets too quickly, let me say. And so good brain stories are very hard to find. One of the problems, of course, is that there's no one story. There are many stories. Just like there are many personalities, many, many ways to be schizophrenic or depressed or autistic, the brain has 1,000 stories. So I'm going to tell one. Okay, I'm going to tell one. It's a good one. And really, to tell it properly, I have to introduce two characters, two oddball characters. The one I call the spaced out student, right? And this really refers to a finding in cognitive science called the spacing effect, or distributed study, which is a very straightforward idea. Your mom might have given you this advice at some point and said, honey, why don't you study an hour tonight and an hour tomorrow instead of 2 hours tonight? Right? Simple advice. Good advice. In fact, it's one of the strongest, most reliable, and oldest findings in all of psychology. And doing that can double what you remember on a delayed test, like a week later, for example. Right? So why is that? I mean, you're not working any harder, you're not spending any more time, and you remember two times as much? Very strange. So that's the first very odd finding in learning science. The other one it's a poetry finding. And this has to do with another finding. This one in the early 1900s, an education researcher named Philip Ballard decided he was going to try to find out why some kids in some schools were performing poorly, right? And those schools were mostly in working class sections of London, the Cockney areas, and he did some very simple experiments. I mean, he was trying to figure out, look, what's wrong with these kids, right? There, is it attention? Are their memories not as good? Are their memories failing? Is the information not staying as long in their brains as in other kids, for example? So he did a very famous experiment. It's very obscure now, but at the time, very strange. He had kids come in. We're talking about middle schoolers. He had them come in and try to memorize poems, like Longfellow's Wreck of the Hesperus was one of the famous ones. Great poem. Give it 10 minutes, take a look at the poem, try to remember as much as you can, put it aside, right? Give them a break, and then write down as many lines as you can. Okay, that was the beginning of the test. And so they wrote down one or two lines, no big deal. I mean, that's about average. And then to test whether there was memory breakdown in between, Ballard then gave them another test on the next day, okay? Same thing. Unannounced, they didn't have any idea it was coming. Write down as many lines as you can. Okay. Now they were writing down 3, 4, 5, 6 lines. Some of them who remembered one were up to 7 lines. They hadn't looked at it again. Okay. They remembered more on the second test than the first. This is so bizarre that he thought, well, what is happening here? I'll test them again. Which he then did the next day. Now day 3. Now they remember more. So this was so strange that Ballard tested hundreds of students, but this particular finding held up. That is that study once, test the next day and the next day, and the information, more information comes back each time. It's so strange because if you can't remember it the first time, how are you getting it the second time or the third? Right. So that's oddball number 2. What's going on there? Right. Now, excuse me while I shift some papers here. Both of those experiments, the poetry one and the spacing one, that was 100 years ago. Right. So since that time, cognitive scientists have filled in the field, so to speak, and they've discovered a whole bunch of other oddball things as well. And all of those findings have forced them to kind of reconsider how things like forgetting and remembering and learning are related. And they've also forced them to sort of tell this great story about the brain, about how the brain works and how it learns. And I'm not going to sort of keep you in suspense. I'm just going to tell you what it is, which is that the brain is a forager for information. You know, if you think about it, all of the institutions of education are recent inventions, you know, the last several thousand years. I mean, they're great inventions, perhaps the greatest that civilized man has made. And they've created sort of enormous scholarship and so on. But the brain's a biological instrument, and humans have been around for 1 million or so years. For almost all that time, the brain has been picking up information on the fly, piecemeal, okay, in all kinds of environments, in different weather, you know, being tested on the fly, and so on. The brain has not yet adjusted biologically to the modern institutions of education, not entirely. And so once you understand that it too is a scavenger or a forager for information rather than food or shelter, you begin to see this much larger picture of how the brain learns. I mean, for me, it's personal because, you know, I became a much better student when I kind of let go, when I threw out learning and went to college. I never understood why, and I really didn't think about it a whole lot until I started to read about these findings. And then I thought, well, look at that, right? And so I think it's just wonderful to learn that, and it's reassuring. And it also takes a lot of the stress out of trying to be a perfect student. You know, there's so much stress, on, especially on kids, to do that these days. So what I'm hoping to do in my conversation with Jenny is to convince you that this is a story that is really worth knowing in detail, because you will see not only the findings, but also the really interesting theory about what they think is happening and how it might apply to your own life now, you know, no matter what you're trying to learn or master.
So what's going on when you study and you think that you know it and you're so ready for that test and you've put in so much time, and then you get to that test and it all goes blank and you forget it? What's going on, and what can we do differently?
Well, I mean, what's most commonly going on, you know, cognitive scientists will tell you, is it's what's called a fluency illusion, which is, you know, just because something, you know something now, you assume that you'll know it, you know, a day from now, 2 days from now, because you can retrieve it now. It's an automatic assumption. We kind of forget that we forget. So you're looking at the material, you have it highlighted, and you think, oh, I know that. Well, you know it because you've just looked at it, not because you've been able to retrieve it. And one of the sort of strongest ways to eliminate that illusion is testing itself. This sounds like testing for better testing. But really, what I'm talking about is self-examination. You know, you don't really know the things you've highlighted until you stand up and tell your brother what they are, or tell your friend, or your mom, or tested yourself on them. That will tell you pretty quickly whether, you know, you really know those things just because, you know, you think you do.
Yeah, exactly. Can you talk about sleep and what role sleep has in memory and learning and the importance of that?
Sure. I mean, sleep is a huge area of research right now in learning. And one of the major theories of why we sleep, scientists have not completely agreed on why we sleep at all. But one of the leading theories is that sleep is learning consolidation. So when you get tired, the brain is essentially telling you, you know, all right, I've had enough of this. It's now time to finish the job, to decide what's important, to sort, you know, the valuable stuff from the less so. And it's an interesting story because sleep has various stages, and those stages seem to be specialized to process different kinds of information. So, for example, the first half of the night is considered retention territory. So if you're studying for a French exam or something, you're studying French words or foreign language, that part of the night is when that material is consolidated, when those memories are really dug in. And the second half of the night has other features, which I can talk about too if you want. But the point is that sleeping is learning. It's a very specialized kind of learning consolidation. It's not, you know, a weakness or just that you don't have the will to push through.
Can you say more about the different levels of sleep or types of sleep, or do you need, you know, a full night's rest in order to consolidate and lock that information in? Or
sure, I mean, a full night's sleep is essentially defined as having four phases plus REM sleep. REM is the sleep where most dreaming occurs, and so you kind of cycle through these phases. The phases are defined by what the waves look like, the electrical waves. And so you have deep sleep, 3 and 4, usually occurs mostly at the beginning of the night, although you're cycling, and stage 2 in REM, mostly in the last half of the night, you know, in the morning hours. And so when I say that the first half of the night is consolidate, or sorry, retention territory, I mean that deep sleep is when strict retention seems to be consolidated best. So when facts, figures, faces, formulas, when you're studying and trying to remember those later. The second half of the night has REM, more REM, and more stage 2 sleep. REM is associated with learning, like seeing hidden patterns and so on. So the research suggests there that, particularly with math problems, you want your full dose of REM in the morning. Stage 2 sleep associated with motor learning. So musicians, too, should sleep in. So, because that's the second half of the night, and that is when motor learning is most efficiently sort of consolidated in the sleeping brain. So you can see, you know, it's a kind of cool story in that it's not sleep is good or bad. It's that sleep does several things during a regular night, and knowing what they are gives you some sense of how to sort of be tactical if you're going to cut into your sleep. You know, do you want to stay up late and study, or do you want to get up early, a little early and study? And that depends on what you're studying for. So if it's a retention test or performance or something, then you want that first half of the night. You got to have it. You get up a little early. And the opposite goes for when, for example, it's a recital or it's a math test where you're going to be, really the comprehension side is going to be tested because that's where the processing is concentrated. You want to have the morning sleep and go ahead and study a little bit later. I hope that makes sense.
Is there any impact in lack of sleep and memories fading and learning falling away if there's not enough sleep?
Falling away, memory, you know, the lack of sleep will certainly slow you down. I mean, that's essentially it. I mean, it sort of follows from what I said before. You're losing that consolidation factor. And also it sorts kind of, sleep has a function of sorting what's meaningful from what's not, you know, the wheat from the chaff kind of thing. And so if you don't sleep, you're losing that function. It doesn't mean you can't do it. You're just not doing it as well.
Mm-hmm. Do the findings apply or not to people with learning disabilities, or how does learning challenge people?
You know, all of this work has been done in people who have no learning disabilities. This is work trying to figure out how regular learning happens. I mean, because it happens in a lot of different ways we don't understand. So I can tell you that some of these findings, which suggest that you can use, you know, restlessness in your favor, you know, breaks and interruptions and moving around and so on, are pretty congenial to people with an ADD diagnosis, because they will tell you that, you know, their problem is not that they don't learn well or efficiently, it's that, you know, they just don't do well when they're made to sit down in the same place for, you know, an hour and a half. But I don't. There's no evidence, direct evidence, saying, for example, that they work, you know, well or not for people with particular diagnoses. This stuff is all done in people without one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you have any particular advice or takeaways for students, learners, and also the same thing, advice that's specifically for parents or educators who are trying to encourage the learning of others?
Right. I think that the advice is different for each one. I mean, I think students. Look, I think that everyone should know the basics, you know, that learning can happen in these multiple ways and that those can be used to your advantage. You have to tailor the technique to what you're trying to master. But what it does, it opens up the world of learning entirely. You don't feel you have to sort of isolate yourself in a room with the books. You're not stowing yourself away. You've got multiple options of what you can do to try to enhance your learning. So for students, you know, if you're old enough, read the book. you can really appreciate all the ways that you can apply specific techniques to whatever it is you're trying to learn. Parents, it depends on the age of the child, I would say. I mean, some kids, you know, a lot of parents in here, you know that, I mean, half of it's just about anxiety, right? And, you know, they're wound up, you know, they don't want to study, they don't like studying, they feel pressured to do something, to study really well, do it right. I mean, half the job is getting the kids settled down to where it's okay. You know, it's not torture, really. So, you know, you do, that's half the job. And I would say for young kids, of course, there are things parents can do coming from this research. I would just say try them one at a time. You can't overload, you know, a 9-year-old with 12 techniques that they can use. But you can with one. For example, it helps to move around when you're learning. You limit yourself if you're studying in just one place. Okay, well, kids like to move around, right? So you can invite, you know, your seven-year-old who's, you know, trying to study vocabulary to move around with the book a little bit, come to the kitchen table, go on the back porch, maybe you go out to a cafe. All of those things reinforce the learning, okay? And they're more fun than sitting kind of in your room trying not to study, you know? So I think for parents, one thing at a time with young kids, absolutely. Teachers already know a lot of this stuff. Not all of it, I think. Depends on the teacher. But the way the system is set up now is teachers have to pass on their tips and their, you know, their study tips kind of on the fly to, you know, well, you should try this, you should try that. There's no set-aside course for what do we know about learning? What is the science of learning? I mean, whoever took something like that, unless it was in grad school? Nobody. That's a course I think that should be taught in schools. Why not? I mean, they're especially around, you know, when they're in middle school, they're learning to be students, and they should be made aware, says me, of these techniques, you know, because they take a lot of the anxiety out of studying, and they work.
Can you say more about what are some of the techniques? So you talked about spaced learning. You talked about moving around. What are some other?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spaced learning, for sure. You have to do it on a schedule, a sort of specific schedule, depending on when the test is. But roughly speaking, you know, an hour today, an hour tomorrow, or the next day for a test in a week. Okay, that's fairly straightforward. Moving around generally increases retention. The more variation, the better. All right. I mean, you don't want to be jogging. I'm just talking about checking around. Another technique is self-examination. We talked about that. Self-examination can take a lot of forms. You can be practicing something in front of the mirror. You can take on the role of the teacher. This is a great thing for younger kids. A lot of them are just hams, and they love to be the teacher. You know, invite your kid to teach you what they've learned. It's a much stronger, learning experience than restudying or continuing to study for another half hour. So those are three. I'll mention one more, and we can kind of go through these slowly. This is a lot, but you know, there's a huge debate about distraction now. You know, do we have too many smartphones? And you know, we're on Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat all at one time. And you know, I've got where I work, you know, you can tell the tech people they've got their laptop here and they got the iPhone going here, and it's, you know, they're nailed to their arms. I mean. So, and they talking, and then they're on the... and I think, look, distractions are clearly bad if you need continuous attention to something, like it's a lecture or something, you're driving. But distraction can be extremely helpful in problem solving. And this is a great area of learning science. And the idea here is that when you're stuck, you know, you are out of ideas on a problem. One of the main reasons that happens is, you know, you've made some assumptions on the problem, perhaps unconsciously. You don't even know you've made them. And you're trying variations on those. You're blocking. You're going down the same two or three pathways. And so it's a very good time to stand up, call a friend, get on Instagram, you know, watch comedy on YouTube, whatever it is. And that does one of two things, maybe both. One thing is it causes some forgetting of your initial assumptions. They're loosened up. And also, the brain is still offline kind of working on the problem, and it's reorganizing some of the information, maybe pulling in some of the, you know, original clues that you're given that you didn't notice before. All that stuff is happening when you're offline and you're doing something that's distracting. So if you're doing it, for problem solving, if you're doing the distraction right at that moment, then that really gives you the best chance of coming back and solving the problem. Not that you'll always solve it, but you'll increase your likelihood.
What do we know about the gender differences in learning?
You know, the learning techniques I describe are really independent of any gender differences. You know, these are studies done in men and women of all ages, and really don't apply to them. I mean, the idea here is to get the most out of what you have, right? And that's the idea. So there's no, in these studies at least, there's no gender difference.
Okay. What do we know about how learning changes with age, and is there any difference in the findings between school-age kids and adult learners?
Well, the answer is no. There really is no difference. There is a whole lot of science on, you know, what they call cognitive decline. You know, I'm familiar with that. But that's also very interesting because there's a debate now. One of the findings, one of the oldest findings in psychology is that starting at like age 25, there's a slow, steady cognitive decline, which basically means your short-term memory, you know, the number of phone numbers you can keep in your head and how quickly you can do calculations, decline steadily. And it doesn't come back. It just keeps going down. So for a long time, people thought, well, that's because, you know, the brain is getting older. So, it's, you know, the cells and the connections and the networks are slowing down, and so just not working as well. But there's some new work now that really suggests that something else may be going on, which is that, look, when you're older, you got a lot more stuff up there, right? So you know, if I ask you to, you know, remember 12 words you've just studied, well, you know, you've got about 50,000 more words than, you know, a 12-year-old has in their head. So it's going to take you just a little longer to get them out. And that's the idea there is that there's a trade-off between what's called fluid intelligence. That's like the cut and slash, how fast can you remember, how many things can you, you know, hold in your head, and what's called crystalline intelligence, which is the slow buildup of knowledge, the kind of thing you use for crossword puzzles and so on. The more crystalline knowledge you have, you know, the I'm getting older, but I know more kind, the harder it is to do the fast stuff because you're carrying more around with you. Right, but to the extent that these things apply to people of all ages, I mean, that's kind of the great part. You can experiment with these various techniques no matter what you're trying to learn or when.
What are some of the things that we can do to help our ability to learn that's outside of the school environment, like music or classical, you know, other studies? What are some of the things that we can do?
Right. Well, I mean, all of these techniques you can use outside the classroom, of course. And they also, by the way, don't apply just to academic things. Right? I mean, sports and music are also learning, motor learning. And a lot of the things that, a lot of the techniques that scientists have found apply also to those. I'll give you one example. You know, I was talking to a friend last night, and he said, look, you can shoot baskets on your own, but it ain't basketball. Right? And part of the point there is that when you're performing or you're playing a game, a competition, you don't get to choose the moves you're going to do. I mean, you're in a situation where you have to integrate a bunch of moves together and perform them all at once. It turns out that it's called mixed practice is very effective for both motor learning, for, like, you know, sports and music, and for academic learning. And by mixed practice, I mean it's similar to what musicians do have done traditionally, which is, you know, you do some scales, then you do some sight reading, then you play a new piece, then an old piece, and you're bouncing around. And what that does is create a more general agility that sharpens each of those skills better than if you just repetitively practice them one at a time. And it sort of builds into the brain the unexpected. You need to be able to use these things sort of all of these skills, and you need to kind of use them, particularly if you're, you know, playing a sport, not in isolation, but along with a whole bunch of other skills. You know, we all did this when we were kids, I think. Certainly I did. There was one skill you wanted to learn more than any other. You know, for me, it was a skateboard move. I practiced it about 5,000 times. Well, fine, except the kid down the block could do it blindfolded, and I know that he wasn't doing it as many times as I was. But what was happening was that he was skating. Right, he was doing lots of different moves, building a general agility that, in the end, you know, taught him the ollie, which is standing jump, hard to do. Point is that that technique applies to academic things like math, but also to motor learning and musical instrument learning. Those are things that are not sort of traditionally academic stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How does emotional state, like anxiety or joy or frustration, affect learning and recall?
Well, look, I mean, if you're in highly emotional, you may not, depending on what it is, you may not recall anything, right? You're going to shut down. Emotional state is one element of, you know, what the scientists call context. You know, some contexts are outside. You know, you're learning in the backyard, or you're learning at the, you know, at the kitchen table. Those are two outside contexts. But context can also be inside. You know, you're studying something when you're feeling depressed, or you're feeling anxious, or you're feeling happy. Now, the, you know, some of the work on this, it's better to be happy. Okay, that's good. That makes sense. You think a little faster. You know, you do a little bit better on tests if you're, you know, in a good mood when you're studying. Problem is, of course, we can't program our moods in the same way. So so the science on this says that just like changing outside environments can deepen memory, so indeed can changing inside environments. That is, it's okay. You can study when you're in a good mood, bad mood, feeling anxious. Each one of those is changing the environment, and you're basically broadening the base of the knowledge, right? You can, none of us can sort of pre-program our moods when we have to perform. The idea is to be able to get the knowledge of the skills no matter what mood you're in. I mean, you go into a test and your girlfriend just broke up with you. I mean, good luck, first of all, right? But if you've studied some of the stuff when you're down, this is the idea, then you may have some that's retrievable, just because you've already done that a little bit. So that's the idea. You know, changing the inside environment also helps. Yeah.
Okay. How effective are the brain strengthening sites like Lumosity?
That was like- right. I don't have a position on that because it's still early days with those sites. It's hard to tell. The science is just quite not there yet, or public or convincing enough to know whether they improve skills that people want. Okay, I mean, if I practice, you know, some brain game 2 hours a day for a month, I'm going to get a lot better on that brain game. But I don't know if it's going to help me with anything else, if you know what I mean. So that's the question with those games. You know, do they improve your performance on just the games, or do they actually improve your sort of general performance on other things, whether it's short-term memory, long-term memory, or, say, puzzle solving? We don't know that yet, so I can't endorse any particular software or games.
Mm-hmm. This one's sort of related. Are there any insights that you have around MOOCs, massively open online courses, or other online learning that is particularly more effective or less effective for learning?
Yeah, MOOCs. No one's studied this. There's a big debate going on about MOOCs, but oh, is it as good as live teaching? And that's a... I don't know that there's resolution to that, because some people say, well, look, it's not like live teaching. You're sitting by yourself. You're just looking on the screen. You can't ask the teacher any questions. You can't ask your fellow students any questions, really, not right away. And there may be something to that. I don't know. I would say that MOOCs are courses. And, you know, it may be that a live course is a better and richer experience. I believe that's probably true. I'm not sure. But it doesn't mean MOOCs are useless. I mean, some people don't have any other alternative. It's a great way to get started on a topic, I think. And you can always add a live course once you get started. I mean, the science on this basically says that variation is fine. It's not just one thing's bad and another thing is good. It's that engaging material in a variety of ways is better than just one. So I think really the jury is out on MOOCs. But some people don't have another alternative way to get that kind of teaching. So I think they're going to be around for a long time.
Yeah. In regards to intentional distractions, is there an optimal ratio of work to distraction? And are there better or worse types of distractions?
I think the optimal ratio is 10 to 90%. Tracy, that's... no. There's no optimal ratio for that. You know, distraction is one of those things you want to have in your pocket for like a Swiss Army knife. Like, all right, or that's not the best example, but I need to get out of this alleyway, right? I'm stuck here. I'm out. I just want to check out. I'll come back, but I want to check out. That's the way to use distractions. And so there's no optimal anything about distractions. Nobody knows, you know, despite what you kind of hear in the sort of popular debate about this, nobody knows if there's, you know, this much distraction is bad or good. It's simply unknown. I mean, our brains adapt to all these things. What the science says, or learning science says, is that it's a very effective way to get out of these, you know, these blind alleys when you're stuck. Period. That's the one to use them.
Okay. This is related. What is the relationship between daydreaming and learning?
Daydreaming, learning. I should know that since I daydream a lot. No one knows, no one has a precise answer for that. However, daydreaming is itself a kind of distraction. Right? It's not a really active one that demands a lot of attention. Maybe you're looking out the window and, you know, imagining yourself on a beach somewhere. But you are disengaging from whatever you're doing. And mind wandering is one of these sort of very hot topics in social psychology right now. And it's absolutely possible, and it's certainly suggested in the research so far, that can indeed help you in these cases. So it's a kind of low-grade distraction. You are separating from the material. Your sort of mind is going somewhere else. And so it allows some of the same things to happen as do when you're, say, on Instagram or you're calling a friend.
Mm-hmm. How has the focus of cognitive science shifted over time, and what are the forces that have contributed to that change?
Well, I don't know that there's one shift. Cognitive science has been all over the place. I've focused on... cognitive science has branched out in many ways. I think the biggest shift in cognitive science is it's a kind of more academic one, which is just... You know, it started out trying to figure out how people thought. What is the thinking process? Tell us what your thinking process is. Then what did you think? It's all about interviewing. This is going back, you know, several decades. Now it's data-driven. Now it's computers. You know, it's people filling out things online. And then you sort of pull all that data together and you make sort of guesses about what's happening that way. That's a sort of academic change. It is a big change.
Okay, is the pyramid of learning on how people learn still hold value?
The first part of that question.
The pyramid of learning.
I don't know what the pyramid of learning
know either.
Is. It's like the food pyramid.
That's what I thought.
You take the point and just press it right in there.
I should probably do that. I thought you would know.
There's stuff I don't know.
Okay, awesome. You knew it, but you forgot.
I pretend, but you know.
Right. You should daydream more, and then you'd remember.
Exactly.
So my eighth grade daughter and her friend are in the same math class, and they come home from school in the afternoons, and they sit at their respective desks in their different homes, and they put their iPhones up, and they do their math together, and they'll say, okay, what, you know, one of them will read question one, and then they'll both work on it, and then they'll say, they're on FaceTime this whole time.
Okay.
And they say, what did you get? And then they talk about their answers, each one. And so they sort of do their homework together. Is this something, as a parent, I should be encouraging? Are they goofing off? Is this a distraction that's healthy? Is this, you know?
Right. Don't encourage too much or they'll stop doing it. That's my first thing. I think you should just let that happen. That's a very good way to engage problems. The reason is, look, first of all, you're talking to a friend, you know, you're both solving them, you're helping each other, you're also engaging both the paper and the phone, right? So you have three different things going on at once. And I think it's hugely helpful. I mean, that's exactly what the change of environment is saying. Mix up the way that you engage the material. Kind of, the more ways you do it, the better. And so she's got three or four things happening all at once. I mean, I think it's really a great way. Like I say, if you encourage it too much, she'll change.
I've often heard that, you know, humans are social animals, and that in order for us to really engage in the learning material, we have to do it in a social and collaborative way. Is that accurate, or is that just sort of spin?
Yeah, no. I mean, I think we learn a ton by ourselves, but I think that You just learn more, and it's usually more fun, depending on who you are, if you can do it with a friend, right? I mean, because you get to talk about stuff, and we all have weak spots in our knowledge. I mean, the story I told about being on the library roof and all that, I mean, that was a guy that, he was my roommate, and he knew certain areas of math better than I did, and vice versa, right? So we used to talk about that. So I don't know if it's trigonometry kind of very well, but he did. So I would ask him questions about that sometimes, and he would ask me stuff about algebra usually. But great, right? I mean, you get somebody giving you advice who knows it better. I mean, teaching you. So I think certainly science supports the collaboration is good. It's multiplying the ways that you're engaging the stuff. Maybe you're joking about it. You know, you go out afterwards, you have a couple beers, now you're talking about it again.
That's for middle school kids, though, right? The beers, okay. Just making sure.
Non-alcoholic beers.
Okay, right. talk about procrastination. What's the best strategy when you have lots of little things to do and one big thing to do, and what's the best approach? And what's the difference between distraction and procrastination? And
the best approach is to start the big thing first. I know there's procrastinators out there. I'm sorry to tell you this. I know that some people just can't help themselves. But look, two things happen. Number one, as soon as you break the seal on something, the project shrinks already. You're doing something, right? The second thing that happens is as soon as you start, you don't have to do much at all. And you can sit there and write four sentences. You can write an outline. You can just think about it. You can call your friend and talk about it. Done. That's a start. You've just started. You haven't done anything, really. You just cracked it. However, then you can do the small things. However, what you've also done is you've started this gears turning in your head, and now you will begin, because you know it's coming. Now you're going to be attuned to any information that's relevant to that project. Anything. It's on the radio. You know, you're doing a paper on Emancipation Proclamation or something like that. If you hear stuff on the radio about slavery, now you're attuned to that. Or you hear people on the bus talking about it. You talk about it with your friends. Your own thoughts, you're tuning into those as well, because the gears are starting to run, because you've already sort of put the boat into the current. The big project started. And even when you're doing the little ones, your brain is now starting to gear up to sort of feed the bigger one. I mean, adults know this. You know, we all have our professions and stuff. It takes a long time to learn this, but you know that when you have something huge to do, once you start doing it, you can feel, you begin to, pick up information and ideas just as you're walking, you're at the grocery store, right? That's the kind of habit you want to get into. And I call it percolation in the book, but it's basically get the damn thing started, and then your brain will begin to feed you more information as you go. You know, you'll have more ideas. Next time you sit down, you will have heard things, you will have discussed it, and now you're loaded. You got more stuff to add. And you haven't worked for it either. It's flowing in. You've just noticed the stuff. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's what the science says on that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What about nutrition? Are there any superfoods, brain foods, power learning food?
Captain Crunch is the best.
Crunch, with crunch berries.
No, I got no idea on that. I really don't. I eat everything, and I don't particularly believe any of the stuff on nutrition and learning. So that's, yeah. I mean, junk food probably doesn't help, but who knows? I don't think anyone knows about that.
Okay.
It's a non-science.
Okay, okay. Yeah. Is there any relationship between learning techniques and the state of flow that we've heard a lot about recently with around athletic performance and musical performance, like learning flow zone or something?
Yeah, no, the flow zone. Yeah, that's a good place to get to, I think. That's a very popular, and why wouldn't it be in psychology? You want to be flowing, like, you're in a kind of a magical state, right? And look, I'm 54. I don't know how many magical states I've been in. Not many. I can tell you that right now. I think, yes, you can be engrossed in something. You're thinking about it, and you may even be doing something else, right? And you're sort of putting your ideas down, and there is we've all done this, where you look up and an hour has passed or something like that. I don't think it looks like meditation or anything like that. I think it's that the brain is moving, and that you are thinking about a particular project. It could be a painting or design or whatever it is, or a problem. And that Yes, a significant portion of your brain is sort of engrossed in that. I don't think there's anything magical about it, right? I think it happens all the time, and it doesn't look magical. You know, you could. I read about this in the book. I had my daughter once come to work with me on a weekend. I had to finish something up, and I thought I was totally engrossed. I planted her at a, you know, a computer, and said, she was 12 or something. I said, "Look, you stay here. I've got to finish this." And I thought I was totally engrossed finishing the story. And she was on the computer, you know, tick, 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 tick. I thought, isn't that great? Maybe she's doing some studying or something like that. Well, it turned out she was like, she was recording my every tick. Like, stands up, scratches ear. Calls friend. First word, dude. You know, walks over to make tea. 50 things. I thought, at first I thought, no way. It didn't happen. But there's no way she could have made those up. You know, I was all over the place. But I was working on that thing. And I think so. I would say that flow happens. It's nothing magical about it. And it doesn't necessarily look the way we think it does. That's all. Yeah.
Is cramming a bad idea? Studying, cramming.
Cramming. Yeah, mostly. It works. It does work. Kind of. We all, those of us who've done it 1,000 times, know that, you know, you can use cramming and do an all-nighter and do great on a test. So we know that's true. Now, then you walk out of that test. I don't know about anyone here, but you don't know nothing about that topic. You don't know how to get home, depending on how much of an all-nighter you pulled. But and that's really the idea with cramming. It's like stuffing a cheap suitcase on the fly. Like, whoa, we get everything in there, and then it's going to hold for a while, but then it's all going to fall out. And so if you talk to teachers, and particular teachers who study this stuff, you know, psychologists, they'll say, some students will come in for that second term, and it's like they never took the first, but they don't remember anything. and so that's the problem with cramming. Spaced study, we talked about it at the beginning, just breaking up the study time a little bit, solves that problem. You know, so the cramming, for example, you might do well on the test the next day, but if that test is delayed a couple days, you don't do well. You've lost the information. It just doesn't stay in that long.
Is there different types of learning techniques for the different types of content that you want to learn? So you've talked a lot about memorizing facts, figures, language, things like that. What if you want to learn how to be a better manager or leader or something that's more difficult to quantify and organize into boxes and things like that? What type of learning do you experience for those different types of content?
Right. I mean, that's a much tougher one to tailor particular techniques to. I mean, how to be a better leader. I would say there that, you know, some of the learning that I describe in this book, sort of the learning that we already do that we don't notice, that's not academic, comes into play when you're trying to learn to be a better leader. I mean, you're doing it by observing other leaders, by listening to what they're saying, watching what they're doing, maybe imitating some of those things, watching people's reactions. I mean, that's the kind of learning we're already designed to do. We don't need, the course may help, but it's not a book learning thing, really, at its core. It's social learning, and most of us do that pretty well. you'd really have to tune yourself to say, okay, what leadership quality, what leader do I like? You know, what kind of leader do I want to be? And what does that look like? And you just, you don't really get that out of a book. You know, I don't think the sleep is going to help. Sleep management is going to help you. You really, yeah.
just take a nap and you'll be a better leader. Can you comment on the thoughts described by Nicholas Carr around the interrupt-driven short attention spans taking place in brains today, and how does it affect critical thinking?
Right. First, I haven't read the book. I know the outline of it. You know, this is one of the big debates going on right now because of the multiplication of distractions we have. You know, is that undermining attention spans? Is it changing the brain? Is it changing the brain? No. I'll answer that one first. No, the brain takes a lot longer to change than 5 years or 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 or 100. Okay, evolution is slow, and there's going to be no structural or functional change at all from the use of these things for many years, if there's any change. So that's the answer to one of them. The other question is tougher to answer about attention spans. Again, attention spans, like I say, concentration doesn't necessarily look like what we think it does. So I may be, in fact, calling a friend. I may be making tea, etc., etc. All those things my daughter recorded. But I am still working on the story and a problem. So it's very difficult to say, I think. I think that obviously some kids are getting, and adults, are getting lost in their phones. Right? We've all seen it, right? whether that's really altering the amount of time they can concentrate on solving a problem they care about, I don't know. I doubt it. We certainly don't have the science to say that's happening.
Mm-hmm. Is it best to practice one skill at a time until it becomes automatic, or work on multiple things at once?
Right. We talked about that a little bit before when I was talking about the basketball moves and trying to mix it up. You want to mix them up. I mean, you need some familiarity with a skill. Again, this is like the musician's example. So you need to play the scales, you need to play the pieces once or twice or three times, work on the weak spots. But once you have familiarity, it really helps to start mixing up. This is particularly true. This is a very hot area in math right now, because kids in math, they do great on the unit tests every week. When they get the exams, they sometimes do terrible. Math teachers know this, and one of the reasons is on the unit during the homework, they know what formula to apply. This is the Pythagorean theorem. There's seven problems. Well, you know what to apply because it's on the top of the homework sheet. Okay? But when you get to the test, no one's telling you what to apply, right? So in those cases, mixed homework sets where you're not told, you're just given the mixed set, are extremely effective because it forces the student to decide what kind of problem he or she is looking at first before applying. Makes it much better taking a test. You're basically doing a test. But it also helps in these motor learning, whether it's music or sports or whatever. Mix up the skills and build general agility once they're familiar.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you. I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, I'd like to thank Ben Carey, New York Times science reporter and author of How We Learn, The Surprising Truth of When, Where, and Why It Happens, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.